This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. We all know that the cost of cancer is high. Half of all cancer patients end up in financial catastrophe within a year of diagnosis. Is there such a thing as affordable cancer treatment? And do high-end treatments give us much better outcomes? How true is all that? To share with us today the value of cancer treatment specialists in making treatment decisions are Dr. Sandri Somasundram, President of the National Cancer Society of Malaysia, and Dr. Paul Korns, Consultant Oncologist. Welcome to the show.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
Lovely to be here too, Lynn.
Let's talk about one of the key things I think that cancer patients fear and that can be very confusing. What is the process by which a treatment plan is decided? I mean, let's skip past diagnosis for now. Once you've heard the news that you fear, and now it's, you know, time to make plans, what happens? What is the process that doctors go through?
Okay, well, the thing is to find out what it is the patient wants. Sometimes there's a very clear answer. If you're going to cure someone, and there's one way to do it, there's not really much point about talking about different options. But, you know, at the moment, we don't cure every cancer, and therefore we're trying to make decisions about how best to prolong good qualities of life. And that means we need to understand a lot about the patient. How do they want communication? Do they want to make the decision themselves? Do they want the information, good and bad, to weigh up? Or do they want me to make the decision? And the first thing is to say, what is it I want, and how do you want to communicate it?
But the issue here, I think, is that what Paul is talking about is the ideal situation where it's patient-centric, where you look at it and you think that the patient comes first and what the patient wants should be the line of treatment. In Malaysia, however, we haven't got to that point yet. Much of the treatment which is given here is doctor-centric, is what I can offer you, what is available. And so this is my cards on the table. Take it or leave it.
Well, that's why we're here to have a dialogue, isn't it? And we're going to change things.
How do you shift over from that doctor-centric model to a patient-centric model?
We have to overcome people's assumptions both ways, that the doctor knows best and that patients aren't informed. We live in an age where information is a flash of a finger away on a screen. And the trouble with our digital era is that the information is massive. And Google is the world's biggest library. It's got the best and the worst books. And that's why when you want to find information, you want to know that your doctor's given it to you clearly. And you also want to know where you can find it. And that's why there's a partnership between people like me, cancer doctors, and cancer societies that have built up to provide information.
How is that interplay for somebody who hasn't yet entered the system? You know, I haven't, thankfully, I'm not a cancer patient, but for a cancer patient, Dr. Sandri, at what point would you enter the process? I mean, I know when I would see Dr. Paul, when I need to understand my treatment options, when I need to receive my treatment. Where do you enter the picture?
I think we enter the picture a lot before that. Basically, for a cancer society, we should be community-based. So even if you don't have cancer, you should be able to know, oh, you know, if I need to find out information, this is the number that I call. Whether or not you have cancer or someone else has cancer, whether a friend, or whether you just want to know, how do I stop cancer from happening? So that number should be at the tip of your fingers. You know, as we say, we should know the fire department, we should know the police station, et cetera, the nearest hospital to you. You should know your cancer society around you as well.
I'd second that, you know, because the current state of cancer is that one in four Malaysians will face cancer before they're 75 years of age. So this isn't a minority illness. I don't know a family that hasn't met it somewhere and had to make difficult decisions. My family is no different. And so when it's that common, knowledge is very important. And what do you want knowledge for? Well, we believe at the moment that half of all the world's cancers are preventable. We know that cancer affects people who are less educated. And when they get cancer, they get less the choice they want and less benefit from treatment. And, you know, if it's an issue about education and knowledge, then we've got to find a way to overcome it. And, you know, you wouldn't have a National Cancer Society that's celebrating its 50th anniversary now if it hadn't been any good. It wouldn't last 50 years, would it, Sunny?
Thank you.
What is the level of awareness and knowledge of cancer and cancer management and their options among Malaysians?
I would say very low, actually. Health literacy in Malaysia is very low for most diseases and even more for cancer itself. And primarily because there's still such a fear and stigma associated with cancer. There's still this whole idea that cancer is something that is fate and you can't do anything about it. And that whatever treatment you do, you're going to die from it. So it's all this you have to debunk first before you're going to get that person to come up to you and ask you questions about the cancer.
Yeah, absolutely crucial. And, you know, I always split risk up into two. You know, there are risks that you can deal with as an individual. You can make choices about your life, for example, smoking, alcohol, what your diet's going to be, that can have a big difference to your risk in the future. And then there's some other risks that you might not be aware of if you didn't know, which is that some tumours, it's unusual, but they can run in families. And that knowledge, spread through a family rather than hidden and not talked about, can be a lifesaver for young patients, can't they?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
What would you say is the level of knowledge among healthcare professionals when it comes to healthcare economics?
I think it's mixed. People mistake economics. Economics is a Greek word. In fact, it's two Greek words, oikos and nomos. And it means wise rules for managing a household. Economics is a bit like medicine. When you first start, you learn these strange technical words because you want to be very precise, communicating doctor to doctor. And I'm sure it's the same for economists. But once you realize it's about wise rules, then health economics is about how you run a clinic, how you run a hospital. Now, everyone's an economist when they spend their own money. Anyone who's bought a car, bought a house, knows that you trade off. Would you spend more for features that you don't want? Value doesn't always go with price. And when we talk about value, remember, value to the Ministry of Health would be measured in something important for them. How many Malaysians can they help live longer and better for the taxpayers' investment? Value for a patient might be incredibly different. Your value might be time spent at home with family, time being able to be at work, time free of symptoms. And, you know, for a young woman, there are some people for whom losing their fertility would be something that they would never trade away, and for other people would be different. And that's the whole point. The discussion, Sandy said, needs to be individualized. What's your value? So remember, economics isn't just about money, it's about values. And we don't ever talk about cheap or expensive in economics. We say things are good value or bad value. But remember, it's value to you. And therefore, if we don't communicate well, we might end up between a patient and myself making a decision that people regret. They wish they'd done differently another time. And when I get it wrong, they go to the Cancer Society and complain, don't they?
Yep. I think that's a conversation that most doctors don't have with their patients, is basically, what's the value to you? The conversation that you do have is that these are the treatments available. This is how much it's going to cost. What are you going to choose? But it goes way beyond that. You have to personalize each treatment to what the patient wants. And when you just put it in terms of money figures of, you know, these are the treatments that are available, the end result or your outcome that you want to have, either as a patient or as a doctor, can vary very, very differently. You could be on either sides of the pole in terms of what you think this is actually going to so-called buy you.
Yeah, so that's about making the wrong assumption, isn't it? And that's why we all need to learn to communicate better. We need to let patients feel they can communicate better with doctors, and doctors need to learn to communicate better with patients, and they need to learn how to use information services and advocacy services. And, of course, that's why we three are here today, to try and make Malaysia's patients feel much more confident asking difficult questions.
How do I do that? How do I ask the quote-unquote right questions when I'm upset? Because I think in most of these situations, they're quite emotionally fraught. You know, I've just been told that I am very ill, possibly, that every decision I make from here on out will have a positive and a negative. I have to weigh everything out. What are the right questions? How do I convey my values to you?
Yeah, that's a very important thing. Well done, Lynn. So what I'd say is this. Always ask, how much time have I got to make that decision? Do you know, none of us chooses a hairstyle or a car in an instant. We weigh things up. And, you know, there are some instances in medicine where minutes matter. You know, if you're bleeding to death after a car crash, you just want the doctors to do the right thing. But there aren't many situations in cancer when having a week to think things over, to seek out information, to ask for copies of the letters the doctors have written, and to discuss it with your family isn't the right answer. So, number one, do I have to make a decision now, or do I have time? Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely true. But I think what's very, very important and what doesn't happen so much in many of the clinics here is that a patient comes up with information. A lot of it is verbal. A lot of what the doctor says, you know, they just tell it to you. But nothing's much is written out. And if you go to a government clinic, you mightn't be able to get your scans. You mightn't even get a letter. So when you walk out with this vague idea, I have cancer of the breast. But you wouldn't be able to say what sort of cancer. I mean, it is, because breast cancer, there's 10 different types of breast cancer, if you want to put it that way. You wouldn't be able to say how extensive it is, what are the different treatments, other than the doctor says I have to do surgery. So I think it's very, very important at the point of when you do get the diagnosis. It's important for both sides, for the clinic to understand that if you're going to give information like this, which is life-changing, that person should have support next to them. And that person should have the opportunity to write down the information or catalog the information in whichever way they feel comfortable with, whether it's actually recording what you say, whether it's by a report which is given to you, or even a leaflet where or a checklist which, you know, gets ticked off, you know, that this is what you have to look about, or, you know, these are the things that you have to think about, etc.
And in some ways it should be the role of the doctor to remind the patient to do that if they're not in the right emotional or, yeah, I guess, mental headspace to do it, right? Because I might not have the presence of mind to think I want to record this or I should write this down.
Nobody has a presence of mind. When I was, I mean, I've never had cancer, but when there was a suspicion of cancer, the first thing which went through my mind, and this was when I was a doctor already, was that I'm not telling my husband. We are supposed to be going for a trip in 2 weeks' time. I'm going for that trip. You know, it's denial. It's pure denial. And so it doesn't really matter how educated you are. The presence of mind just goes when you hear that word cancer.
It's very visceral.
I'd always say, firstly, take a trusted friend with you. It might not always be family. You know, when, as you said, things can get very emotional. So one of your friends with a clear head, say to the doctor, do you mind if I take notes? Or say, what are the important things I should write down? What are things I need to know? And, you know, don't be scared. All your smartphones can record conversations now. Don't hide it under the table. Put it on the table and say, doctor, can I record this so when I get home I can play it back? Because, you know, I've got grey hair now. I've lived through all this change. I've lived through the era of top-down doctors' decisions and then the realisation that we've got that wrong and trying to bring through better ways of communicating. So you're right, we've got, you know, booklets about the disease. No one should ever go home without some written information. We've been through a recording. One of my colleagues at work pioneered bringing tape recorders into clinic, and now everyone has one on their phone. It used to be that the patient came in alone. We now use the trusted friend. We have the idea of bringing nurses in. Doctors speak a very technical language, I said, like economists. We want to be very precise. But sometimes that's got to be turned into something that people really understand. So it's all about communication. And, you know you're facing a difficult decision, research it beforehand. No one goes into the car showroom without having thought about the cars, knowing what they cost, what performance they do. And that's why, if you know you're facing that decision, go to the cancer societies and information centres first to work out what questions are best for you to ask.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking today with Dr. Paul Coins, consultant oncologist, and Dr. Soundri Somasundaram, president of the National Cancer Society Malaysia. And they're representing, I guess, two important parts of trying to identify the best possible plan for patients, the best possible means of communication. We've been discussing all that. Up next, the role of the specialist in making decisions and how much weight cost factors into that. If you've got any questions, do give us a call. That number to ring is 03-77-109-000. You can also text us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Dr. Sandri Somasundaram, President of the National Cancer Society Malaysia, and Dr. Paul Korns, Consultant Oncologist. And we're talking about affordable cancer treatments, but also the process of trying to find the right path through this very difficult disease for patients. If you've got any questions about cancer, about affordability, about how to make the right decisions, give us a call. That number is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, what do we know about, I guess, are we, between the two of you, what needs to be done to meet the needs of cancer patients? What have you identified as kind of those key things that require addressing?
It's about communicating and asking. Our colleagues in Ontario, Canada, did a survey of people going through cancer treatment in their centre. And instead of asking the question, do you suffer from this symptom and that symptom, they asked an open question. They said, what haven't we put right? What's wrong that we haven't put right? And what was interesting is the top six things they hadn't put right, none of them would be made better by a medicine. They were about fear, about having made the wrong choice, about lack of information. And that's taught me something very important that Sandy and I discussed, which is that that shows the incredible importance of information, dialogue during treatment. I'm not going to make people less scared if I don't give them information, if that's what they want.
Exactly. I think doctors here tend to focus on the disease itself and the treatment options which are available. They don't actually see a person in front of them. They just see a number. And unfortunately, that is true in many of the government centres we have because of time. You don't have time to sit there and view a patient.
But you know, you can make your best use of time. And our colleagues in Leeds in Britain did a very interesting study. They looked at people going through treatment and they brought out a checklist of symptoms, things that people might be suffering. And they did a study where half the people going to the clinic were given this list and half weren't. And then they tape recorded the clinic and asked nurses to listen to the tape, coming back cancer nurses, and said, do you think the doctor addressed the patient's problems? And they discovered that when the patients had a checklist and they'd thought beforehand to focus their questions, in the same time in the clinic, the doctor addressed more of their problems. You know, sometimes when you have a friend that you're a bit uncomfortable with, the dialogue goes backwards and forwards and you don't quite get down to say what you wanted to say. It's no different in the clinic, is it?
Exactly. It isn't. And I think doctors here also don't know how much information to give. As you know, in Malaysia, it's not so much patients that make the decisions, it's families as well. So when you have different voices coming at you, you tend to just be very, not so much clear, but very concise with the amount of information that is given because you don't want the time to escalate out. So I think it's really, really important for the doctor to actually address the patient and not just the family, but the patient themselves, and try to assess what the needs are of the patient before the voices of the family overwhelm.
So between the specialist, the patient, and the family, who makes the call ultimately? What is the role of the specialist in making decisions? Because I think we're talking about trying to empower patients. I mean, that's the word, we haven't used it, but really in many ways that's what it is. Having said that, here I think many people kind of still, there is still a very patriarchal notion of what a doctor is, who that doctor should be, and, you know, what they say goes.
I think the problem, what we have here, just very quickly in Malaysia, is that the patient doesn't see the doctor as someone they can communicate with. The doctor is someone to give information, but not someone to communicate with. And if I don't like what the doctor is saying, it's not so much that I will sit there and have this discussion with the doctor, but I'll say, okay, I want to go and have a second opinion because I'm not hearing what I want to hear.
Do you know, sometimes you need a second chance, not a second opinion. Because when you're choosing treatments, there are some really important questions you can ask. How big is the difference this treatment makes? And make it very plain. For every 10 women I treat with this cancer, how many would I make a difference for? I'm going to make a difference for one. Doesn't sound very valuable. What about 8 out of 10? Most people will benefit. What number of people get side effects? What are they? Give it in a figure I can understand. Because we've shown that doctors communicate the risks and benefits of treatment sometimes in terms that we don't really get. So stop them and say, make that plain. for every 10 people, how many benefit? And the second question I'd always ask, after how big is the benefit and what's the size of the risk? The second one, how good is your evidence? What's the strength of evidence? So we rank evidence from the best and the worst. And the best is when there's what's called a randomized trial. You truly know that the difference between the patients, the treatments, is caused by the treatment. The worst is when doctors have seen someone respond. They call it anecdotal. And they kind of go with their instinct rather than with their head. So, do you know, no doctor who's recommending treatment shouldn't know that evidence and be prepared to explain it. What are you recommending and why are you recommending it?
We have a call here from LTY. Good afternoon, LTY.
Yeah, good afternoon, Lynn. And good afternoon, doctors. How are you?
Good afternoon.
You?
I'm
good
very
afternoon.
Well enjoying
yes,
it, Ian.
Nice to hear that. I have a personal question, all right? I am a smoker for more than 50 years. More than 50 years. My father, my grandmother also smoked. But there's no incident of lung cancer, okay? But you see, since I'm a smoker, there is a very good chance of mutation at any time. I'm now 73. In fact, in my mindset, I do expect the incident of lung cancer for myself, say at 2 years, say at the age of 35, all right? Now, how would you advise me, Dr. Weber? Because by virtue of my age, I already 75, it's almost quite near the end. Would you advise for treatment or not? Can you give us a rundown, even for not for me, also for some elderly smokers? Thank you very much. Any question?
It's a pleasure. Now, what an important question to ask.
Yes, because, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks, yeah. LTY.
What an important question to ask, LTY, because look, we know people who've done bad things all their life, never exercised, smoked, drunk, who live to be 100. And look, this is an element of chance. The trouble with cancer is it's disease primarily of aging, which is why countries where people don't live very long, cancer isn't a problem. But now when we're so good at treating heart disease and preventing other problems, we live long enough to get cancer. And here's the trouble. You may be in your 70s now, but God willing, you might live a long time. And it's really about how well you live. People tell us they don't want to live forever. They want to live well. And I tell you, lung and throat cancer is a miserable thing. And if I could really stop one thing, it would be smoking. If you look at the risks of cancer, half of all the risks of cancer come down to smoking. It's bigger than anything else. Once you've stopped smoking, then you can worry about your diet and exercise. And I want to tell people that the benefits of smoking cessation start very quickly. Within a few weeks of treatment, people's breathing gets better. Within a year or two of treatment, their heart attack risk falls, never goes back to zero, and it takes a bit longer for their cancer risk to fall. We measure risk in how many years you smoked. But it's very hard to give up. 50 years is a long time. Nicotine's a drug that people like, isn't it? I mean, we all get our coffee and tea in the morning, and we wouldn't want to be told to give it up, and people didn't like to be told to give up smoking. So, do you know, to try and get over that risk, it's hard. You need help. Sandy, how do you make people give up smoking? Because I can frighten them like this and say, please, please, please give up. But how do you help them?
And we've tried this with LTY before. I should mention this. That
LTY. Well, let's try
come,
again.
Yes. Come to our clinic. Come to the National Cancer Society. We have a smoking cessation clinic. Come and see whether we can help you there.
It's important because, you know, there are many ways you can help people give up. And you can't change a lifetime habit in some people. But I'd want to try because I think it makes a difference to what happens next. And there are many ways you can help. Some people just want to make the decision one day and not. Other people set themselves a target and reduce it. I'll start my first cigarette later in the day. Other people really need the nicotine and they won't do it without nicotine replacement. That's patches. And the other thing I'd say is you're doing it not just for you. There are younger members of your family, and when smoking is normal in your family, we know that the next generation take up smoking too. And very importantly, because I'm a dad, you know, I've got a young daughter, and I want to make sure she lives a long and happy life. If you haven't taken up smoking by the time you're 25, you probably won't ever take up smoking. So if we show that smoking isn't normal anymore, that it's something that we want to take out of society, then the next generation won't need smoking cessation clinics at the National Society, will they?
Yep.
We have a question via text, and we'll say this again at the end of the show, but in the meantime, what is the URL of the Cancer Society? What is the website, and how else can they reach you?
Okay. Our website is www.cancer.org.my. You can also, we have a Facebook, we also have Twitter, very social. but now what we do have, which I'd like to implore people to use, is that we actually have a helpline. For someone who's diagnosed with cancer now, you don't actually have to come to us anymore because we have a toll-free helpline that you can call, and it's manned by trained nurses who can answer your questions. Let's be very clear here. We're not here as a doctor for you. We're not here to replace your physician or your doctor. But what we can do is talk about the unmet needs that you might have in terms of financial, in terms of explaining what your cancer is all about. The questions that you're too scared to ask the doctor, you think are too inconsequential to ask your doctor. We're there to be able to help you with those questions. And we can also help in terms of framing the questions for you so that when you go to your next doctor's appointment, you know what to ask.
And that number?
That number is 1-800-08-1000.
If you'd like to ask Dr. Paul or Dr. Soundry any questions about affordable cancer treatment or the path towards finding the right cancer plan for yourself or for a loved one, give us a call. That number is 03-77-109000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, when it comes to that decision-making process, how much weight does cost factor into this?
It factors on many ways. We listened at the IKN this week to the results of surveys for what was happening to real patients in Malaysia. And we discovered that it had devastating financial consequences for many families, that the families used up their savings. Now, that suggests that we've got things wrong. And there are two reasons that a catastrophic financial problem would arise. One is that you're buying a treatment that really, really makes a difference. And, you know, there are some times when giving up your summer holiday, selling the car might be worth it, and there are other times when they're not. So remember, there's a big distinction between price and value. I illustrated it at the IKN to all our young trainees by saying, look, diamonds are $7,500 a carat, but they don't make you live longer. Water costs next to nothing without it for a day or two, and you'll die. So the question is, what's really valuable to me? We keep coming back to values, don't we, and finding out what the values are. So, you know, through the International Agency for the Research on Cancer, they've worked out an affordable care plan, and we understand that 90% of the benefit of cancer treatment can be delivered by cheap, simple therapies, short courses of radiotherapy, straightforward operations, and drugs that have expired their patent so they can be copied as generics and biosimilars, which are cheaper yet equally good. And so always ask your doctor, if money is an issue, be straightforward and say, what offers the best value for money? But don't leave out the question about my values.
Yeah. What about subsequent rounds of medicine? Because there might be the temptation to say, well, okay, I think I can afford, you know, this first round of this magic drug that I've heard of that seems to work, but I know that it's going to wipe me out, but I want to live, you know? And so there's that element, I think, of there's that element of desperation that enters the picture when you feel like your life is at stake.
I think that's where communication comes in the sense that when you make decisions about treatment, it should be made by a multidisciplinary team so that you look at the whole journey that you're going to go through, not just this part of the journey, because the cancer journey can be very, very long. So from the start, it should be explained to everyone. The problem is that we tend to break down information and saying, okay, let's deal with this first and think about other things later. But that's wrong as well, because it gives false expectations to the patient. For the patient, it's like, okay, if I deal with this, that's it. I have nothing else to do. Not realizing that, you know, just doing surgery is just the first part, and then you have to go through your chemotherapy or your radiation. And then when you get told about it later on, you feel cheated. You feel, you know, you lose confidence with your doctor.
It's a big change for us, and we now talk about pathways through cancer. And, you know, with paths, you have choices. You can take different routes through, and that's why we talk about pathway planning. And when we plan national cancer priorities, we look at the pathway and say, which change of path would make the most difference? And doctors should be able to give you the map to help guide you through it.
Do high-end treatments give better outcomes?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. I can tell you that a survey of the most recent high-cost drugs licensed in Europe and America, show very little link between price and quality. And that's quality in benefits for the patient. And we measure the benefit in two ways. The extra length of life it buys you, and then the quality of life it buys you. So, for example, you might accept a treatment that adds a lot of life and yet temporarily makes you very ill because it has a long-term gain. But if the treatment only had a moderate benefit, then you'd want to know that it didn't have many side effects. It wasn't going to risk making things worse.
We have a question from a listener. My friend at the age of 80 plus had a breast removed and was given a hormone pill to take daily. What is that? Why? And I guess, why is that? And at her age, can the hormones be that high to need this?
Isn't this one? It's a wonderful question. And this was a treatment pioneered by one of the people that taught me, Michael Baum, at the University College in London, who worked to find out how hormone drugs could make such a difference. And it's typically a drug called tamoxifen, which costs just a few pence a tablet. And it was our first targeted therapy, a therapy that would home in onto the tissues and stop the tumour growing. And Michael Baum and his team ran something called the Golden Oldies Trial. They said when you reach 80, you don't want to spend time in hospital. You don't want side effects. Often you're frail, you've got other illnesses, arthritis, things like that. And they said, look, if we use this tablet that targets cancer, would that mean we could avoid more expensive, more toxic, more time-wasting treatments? And he showed, for many people of senior years, this tablet even replaced surgery. They would give it to people and only use other treatments when that simple treatment had failed. And isn't that what shows the wonderful power of proper clinical trials? People of that age now have a choice based on the generosity of others to have joined trials where half the women had the tamoxifen or hormone treatment up first, and the other half went through a perhaps more traditional aggressive path, and we've learned now what's the right way to go through that journey. And it's for that age, for many of you, ask your doctor, would a low toxicity option first, reserving more serious treatments for later, be good for me?
Why is cancer becoming more expensive when treatments for most other diseases typically become cheaper over the course of the years? I mean, you mentioned that that pill would have been a few pence at this point, but by and large, the burden of cancer is very heavy.
We know worldwide that cancer is the most important disease in the world. It's the biggest cause of death, and it's the greatest cause of economic loss. And you know, the biggest loss of finance from cancer is the loss of productivity for families. It's taking people out of work, taking family members away to look after people. So there's a big cost to cancer, and it's mainly borne by individuals and families. When you look at the cost of treatment, one of the reasons it's got so expensive is because we've been learning to research a new class of treatment. It's called precision targeted therapy. And it's often made in living cells, and so we call it biologic therapy, but sometimes they're chemicals. And the research needed to develop this is very expensive. Now, in time, we know it'll become less expensive. But this has been such an exciting area that universities have stepped in and pharmaceutical companies have really thrown their weight behind it. And we have had an explosion in drug discovery. Now, all that research and discovery needs money to pay back. It's been estimated that it's costing more than $1 billion to bring a new cancer drug through all its research trials to market. People want to know their drugs are well tested, and that has to be paid off. And to reward innovation, countries like Malaysia and Europe and America reward those drug makers with a patent, which means they have a monopoly on the drug for a time, but then they have to give the monopoly up, and they have to reveal the secrets of how they did it so that other people can copy it. So really, it's because the last 10 years have been so innovative, but the next 10 years offer an opportunity for those innovative drugs now to be turned into real value for patients.
So we can expect that to kind of even out in the long run.
We can, and you know, Malaysia's been in the forefront of this. The World Health Organization, that's the governing body for all medicines in the world, has a committee expressly designed to bring through these cheaper drugs, and they call them biosimilars. And Malaysia's, what some of their chief regulators have sat on the WHO committee and formed the standards for the world. And that's why Malaysia unique amongst many Asian nations, has very tough drug regulators, and the result is that you're getting high-quality drugs coming through in this class. And we're hoping over the next few years to bring through some of the really important drugs to make them affordable for Malaysians or free for Malaysians, and that's a wonderful thing.
And I think that's one of the hard questions that a cancer patient should ask their doctor, is that whether they're being given original drugs or they're being given generics, which can do the work for them, but at a quarter of the cost. And in many private hospitals, the general rule is that we will use originals. And that would increase your costs by over 80%.
It's true. And, you know, in many countries in Asia, where the drug regulators have not been strong, they have low-quality drugs coming through. A survey of one of the most useful drugs in breast cancer that's made partly out of pine needles and then chemically synthesized showed that there were very poor quality drugs available. And that's why, although it may be cheap to buy drugs in some of our neighboring countries, you've got to sometimes ask the link about quality too. So let's hear a big round of applause for Malaysia's drug regulators, who not only do it for Malaysia, but are prepared to give their time up to the WHO committee to bring this to the world.
We have a follow-up question from the listener about her 80-year-old friend who says, how could an 80-year-old have such high hormone levels after menopause?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Mostly the fertility hormones are made through our ovaries. And you're right, after menopause, these shut down. But we've learnt that quite small levels can drive sensitive tissues. That's why we know, for example, that hormone replacement therapy that's very good for your bones and a lot of women's well-being increases subtly the risk of these tumours. But it's a remarkable thing that this drug was discovered. It was always discovered by mistake. It was being designed as a contraceptive. But it's turned out to be a lifesaver for many women. So in Britain, where the drug was discovered, we were facing a rising epidemic of breast cancer through the 1960s and 70s. But we have seen the biggest fall in breast cancer mortality of any developed country of the world. And this, we think, is because Britain utilized these drugs first and for the most people that were available. And also because our statisticians in Britain got all the world's researchers together and made them pool their data in what's called a meta-analysis, so that they could realize the strength of treatment in its true form. And they've now gathered the data on tens of thousands of women over 15 years. And remarkably, low toxicity, cheap drugs can do wonderful things, which is why the World Health Organization has an essential drugs list for cancer. These are the medicines that you wouldn't wish to miss out on. So if you're seeing a doctor and debating about a high-cost medicine, say, is it an essential drug for cancer, one that will make a real, durable difference to my life? And of course, when you're in financial hardship, sometimes that blinds you to making the right decision. Ask, have I got time to think about it? Have I got time to discuss it with information sources like the Cancer Society? And I guess, Sandy, you get lots of calls about that, don't you?
We do. I mean, back to the question which is asked, though. I think it's not so much that the lady should be focusing on how does an 80-year-old have such high amounts of hormones. It's basically how sensitive is the cancer to that hormone. So even if you've got very low levels of hormone, which all of us do, irrespective of whether you're 80 years old, it's how sensitive that cancer is to that hormone, and that's why the drug works.
It's important because not every wonder drug works well in every cancer. We talk about cancer as though it's one illness, don't we? But, you know, cancer is 200 different diseases with 200 different patterns of how it grows and spread, 200 different pathways. And therefore, the treatment of your friend with their cancer may be very different to yours. And that can be confusing to patients, can't it?
Exactly.
Another question. I would like to inquire about intestinal metaplasia. Is it reversible and is it cancerous?
Now, that's a very good question. So, look, we focus on prevention and early diagnosis in all its forms. And you're right, for many tumours, for many cancers, there's a phase that could be picked up early where intervention would make a difference. Now, metaplasia is one of those dreadful Greek words we use in cancer. It just means lots of different shapes. So instead of the tissues of the bowel, if it's there, or the milk ducts of the breast or your skin being regular and even, it's disrupted. And we've learnt that many of the early steps in the pathway to cancer can be reversed. So some of the subtle changes caused by smoking, when you smoke, when you give up smoking, will regress. We know, for example, that some women have a terrible scare with a cervix smear. The doctors say it's not normal, but they say, let's wait, let's do the smear again, and sometimes those regress. So it's very important when people tell you a lovely Greek word, is this a precancer? Is it a stage where I should do treatment now? Or is it one we just need to watch? And this is why screening to look for some of these earliest changes can be so important, isn't it?
And finally, to close off, because sadly we're running out of time, what would your advice be? We've kind of wandered across a very wide range of topics, but if you really had to say to people, look, the next time you go into your doctor's, the next time you go to see your doctors, the next time there is this introduction of cancer into the conversation, what are the questions that people should be asking?
Take a trusted friend. It may not be your husband and wife. It may be perhaps a friend you're not closest to, but the one who'll keep their head, get the notes. Ask, explain the risks and benefits in terms that I understand, and doctor, don't be upset if I come back and ask another question. Please, can I have written information? I'd like a copy of the letter you've written to my family doctor. Don't worry if you use technical terms. I'm going to the Cancer Society, the Information Centre, to get it translated to what I understand. So it's really, the thing comes down in the end, communication and finding out what you want. It's personalised therapy.
Exactly. I mean, it's exactly what Paul said. And I think it's important to remember that when you're given a cancer diagnosis, you do not become that cancer. You still have identity. You still have a life outside of that diagnosis. And whatever decisions that you make should encompass that life that you have as well.
And if you have got any questions, you can call the National Cancer Society's toll-free helpline, which again is 1-800-08-1000. Thank you both very much for coming in today.
It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Dr. Paul Corns and Dr. Soundri Somasundaram about cancer treatment and how you can kind of ask the right questions, communicate better, and find out the right plan for you. You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.